Okay. So today with me, I have Nahid, who is going to talk about she just came back from a trip from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and today's conversation will sort of center on, you know, what is the feeling and what does the region sort of feel like, and sort of what is the conversations going on the ground in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, I think especially for our U.S. audience, you know, U.S. has been involved in Afghanistan and Pakistan for, you know, I think about a third of my life, so about 10 years, so from 2001 to 2013. And so, you know, this is probably the first time in a long time that people are, you know, the U.S. is withdrawing and reducing its commitment. And so in our series on Afghanistan, we want to sort of look at it and sort of try to understand, you know, what might happen, what is happening, what might happen, and, you know, what do people on the ground think about this? I mean, this is a huge change. So let me start off with Nahid. You know, with your trip to Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know, what cities did you visit? I mean, let me frame it this way. Did you just stick to cities too? I mean, did you sort of go out into the country and see what's up, or did you stick to mostly the cities?
Well, I mean, I did get a chance to travel around a bit. I mean, I do want to clarify one thing. This isn't the first big American withdrawal from the region. I mean, we saw a similar withdrawal in the 1980s as well. And so I think that there is a lot of hearkening back to lessons learned in the region. And I think a big part of the lesson that people will talk about is that, you know, I mean, I think there are some thoughtful, there are a lot of thoughtful positions coming out that we can't let things go back the way they did the last time the Americans pulled out from the region. And certainly the relationship with Pakistan is one that's been going on since Pakistan was created. So it's not as though the Pakistanis don't have any sort of, you know, sort of a long view on its relationship with the U.S. But we'll get back to that afterwards. In terms of Pakistan, excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. In terms of Pakistan, I had the opportunity. I went to Lahore. I was in Islamabad. I was in Karachi, Quetta, Peshawar. I didn't have too much time to kind of go into the smaller towns. You know, I wanted to make a trip to Multan. I wanted to go to Hyderabad. I just didn't have any time. I ran out of time. In Afghanistan, I spent time mostly in Kabul, but I was in Herat for a while as well, in Western Afghanistan, with the border with Iran. So that was a very interesting experience. It's a very different, environment from Kabul, very different conversations that I was hearing. So that was a good opportunity to get out there and see what was happening as well.
Interesting. So, I mean, let's start with sort of, you know, how did you travel between Pakistan and Afghanistan? I know this sounds sort of silly, but, you know, I'm sort of curious, was it a natural trip in the sense that, you know, there's considerations of trade that Pakistanis are sort of, the Pakistani government wants to sort of foster trade with Afghanistan, and sort of that first step is sort of opening up routes and sort of airlines and, you know, sort of considering Kabul as sort of a hub for, you know, natural travel. I mean, was sort of traveling to Afghanistan from Pakistan sort of, was it easy, or was it, you know, were there a lot of barriers in your way and sort of, you know, paperwork?
Well, it's very straightforward. I mean, it's not a problem at all. I think that one thing that is sometimes difficult for Westerners to parse out is that the relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan, between Pakistanis and Afghans in general, is one that's always been a natural relationship. There's been a lot of, we tend to focus more because of our distance and because of our interest. And by us, I mean Westerners. We tend to focus more on sort of the political relationship, which has always been fraught, which has always been hostile. And there are a variety of reasons for that. And no, it hasn't always been Pakistan as the aggressor. I mean, if you look back in history, there have been, you know, quite a few examples of sort of mutual hostility. And that certainly still exists. There's very much within Pakistan an anti-Afghanistan sentiment, and within Afghanistan an anti-Pakistan sentiment. I'm pretty confident in saying that that hasn't, in my experience, trickled down to the people. You know, because of the way I look, my roots are in the region. The way I look, Afghans assume I'm Afghan. My name is a typical sort of Afghan name as well. And so obviously the assumption is I'm an Afghan. They'll talk to me like I'm an Afghan, but I obviously have to very quickly own up to the fact that I'm not, and I don't speak their language. And I've never faced any kind of hostility in terms of, oh, you're Pakistani, this, that, and the other. So in terms of those human relationships have always existed. And it's not just the relationship at the Durand line and sort of that mythical relationship of, oh, the border doesn't exist and people go back and forth all day, every day, which they do. But even the relationship between people in the cities, you go to Kabul, for example, and you will meet scores and scores and scores of people who've spent a huge amount of their life living in Pakistan, and they don't necessarily have anything negative to say about it. I mean, they have their issues around policy and that kind of thing, but they're not angry about Pakistanis, and the same exists within Pakistan. So as far as traveling goes, I got my visa in Canada, and it's traveling to Kabul is from Islamabad is the same as traveling anywhere else from Islamabad. The thing that I did notice that's a little bit different in the years past. I mean, I've been going to Afghanistan fairly regularly since probably about the last 5 or 6 years, and the flights used to be different. I mean, I've taken the same exact flight, same time, same day, same airline each time that I've gone, and it used to be very much heavy on the business people. It was the same kind of people that were traveling constantly. Now it's more families. It's Afghans who are settled in Pakistan who'll go to Afghanistan for a vacation, or they'll go for just for a quick trip. Lots of women and children. So the sort of the type of passenger who's going, that's changed substantially. And I found that within Afghanistan, there's tons of Pakistanis that are working there as well, and they all still seem to be there. I mean, at least the ones that I knew. No one's sort of packing up and leaving because of what's going on. I get a lot of warnings from Afghans saying, "Oh, don't tell anybody who." And I get a lot of warning from Americans, "Don't tell anybody you're Pakistani." That's just never borne out for me. I've always found it fairly easy to be there, and people have always treated me really respectfully and very nicely. And that's the experience that I've had.
Interesting. So, I mean, where would you put the United States, and not just the United States, and NATO, and the sort of, those allies? Where would you put them in this relationship, and how do people sort of, view the United States within the Pakistani-Afghani relationship? I mean, is sort of, for an Afghani, do they see the U.S. as biased towards Pakistan? For the Pakistanis, they see the U.S. as, sort of biased towards Afghanistan. I mean, how does this, where does the US sort of fall into the common narrative?
Well, I think that, I mean, basically what you'll find is that, just like anywhere else, people are nuanced about their position on quote unquote outside interference. I mean, like I said, the relationship between Pakistan and the US is a long one. It's not something that started in 2001. It's one that goes way, way back. People in Pakistan and Afghanistan, they aspire to find education in the United States. I mean, everybody's always looking for a way to get some American education. The Americans run a lot of programs in these countries that are, for lack of a better term, more sort of in line with soft power, right? Like their cultural programs, they fund a lot of things. And so what you'll find is that people do have a nuanced relationship. I mean, when it comes to the politics, obviously the sort of the very the very obvious conversation right now is about the US's military role in the region. And that's a very obvious kind of conversation that's been happening. And in Afghanistan, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. I think that people are really they're basically unsure of what's going to happen. I think it's, there's one side that really says that, Afghans can effectively take over and carry on and start, and keep prodding their country toward a better place. And there are others who say that things are essentially going to collapse. Are they going to collapse to the extent of civil war in the 90s? To me, that seems like an unrealistic projection. I think that, in Afghanistan, what you really see is, the people are very ethnically divided, and you know, and there's a real sense that that those types of divisions are simply going to reassert themselves. I would say that they're not going to. I mean, I wouldn't say that they'll somehow be regenerated. I don't think they ever went away. I think that there was to a great degree an attempt to kind of hide them or to tamp them down a bit. But I think they're essentially going to reassert themselves. And anyone who thinks that those relationships haven't had an impact or haven't been having an impact over the course of the last decade or so, I think those people would be wrong. And so certainly on the Afghanistan side, that is a real concern in terms of how things are going to move forward. You'll see that people have been talking about holding on to their money, for example. People don't really want to be spending what they have. They don't want to build new things. They don't want to buy new things. They want to see, you know, kind of ride out 2014, maybe 2015, and see what happens. They also see a lot of the money drying up. Even though money is being pledged at a pretty good rate, and there is a lot of money, depending on who you talk to, there is a lot of money in terms of the sort of the development side of things. But in general, people see themselves as being in an uncertain position. On the Pakistan side, I would say that those types of concerns are obviously less pronounced. I mean, the thing is, it's also important to understand that sitting over here, it seems like the number one concern would be what's going to happen once the Americans leave. That is certainly a concern. I wouldn't say that it's the primary concern. Like in Pakistan, for example, I wouldn't even say that that's a major concern. I mean, the major concern in that country really has to do with things like electricity and water and you know, militancy and you know, sort of the kind of the really paralysis of government in that country. You know, they have sort of bigger issues than whether or not the Americans are you know, what the Americans are doing in Afghanistan in that immediate kind of sense. As far as people saying that there's some sense that drone strikes might stop, I don't think that that's actually a conversation that's realistic. I haven't heard anybody realistically put forward the idea that once the Americans leave Afghanistan, that somehow drone strikes are going to stop. I don't think that's the case at all.
So you mentioned you went to Herat. You
Yeah.
know, it's what is the feeling in Herat? I mean, it seems like if we look back to the 90s, I mean, it seems like when Afghanistan was sort of divided in its civil war, that Herat became a sort of center of activity for Hazara Iranians. You know, sort of the to put it roughly, I mean, this is a rough sort of understanding of history: the north versus the south, sort of Herat versus Kabul versus Kandahar. So, I mean, what is the feeling in Herat? I mean, it seems like, you know, is it, you know, when the United States pulls out, you know, let me back up a little. What are the conversations in the city? I mean, do they accept, is there an acceptance of the central government in Kabul? Is it, you know, people just want to just sort of mind their own business and make money? What is, you know, what is the feeling?
Well, I think what's interesting, I mean, Herat has a very different feel than Kabul does. I mean, it's obviously a much, much smaller place than Kabul. I mean, just going out, you'll see it's a lot more orderly, it's a lot more clean. You know, people behave in a much different way. There's a lot more civility. All of these things can certainly be put down. I mean, everybody says that about the big city versus a smaller town, right? I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily anything different. Outside of just, you know, Kabul is sort of this, you know, as far as Afghanistan goes, Kabul is essentially a metropolis, right? But in Herat, I think, so there was an interesting thing that was happening while I was there. So the previous governor of Herat was an Afghan Canadian, and he'd been appointed to his position. Governors are appointed by the central government, and he'd been appointed to his position. Think 4 years ago, and so basically, what had happened was, you know, people were pretty happy with him. He'd sort of set out these really ambitious economic programs, and he had really kind of stuck to them and managed to accomplish a lot. The interesting debate that was happening about him was that, you know, he wasn't really an insider, right? He was somebody he has a PhD. He was somebody with a more of a technical background, but he wasn't really sort of an insidery kind of person. And there was a real concern as to whether, initially, as to whether he could be effective. He didn't really have any of those patronage type relationships in Herat. And Herat is, excuse me, definitely a place where patronage is important. I mean, it's important throughout, but I mean, with the level of influence that somebody like Ismail Khan has had in Herat historically, there was a real concern that he wouldn't be able to kind of get those relationships going. In any case, he'd managed to be fairly effective. And so what had happened was that at one point Ismail Khan, who was the former governor and as everyone knows, sort of an he's also he's the, currently the minister of water, I think, water and energy or something. And he had basically, I mean, this is essentially his fiefdom, right? I mean, this is the place where he fought his war. This is the place where he basically ran a militia. This is his domain. And basically, the governor had started to complain of interference by Ismail Khan as well as his allies in government, to the extent, and using the IDLG, the Directorate for Local Governance, to basically start blocking his decisions, to the point where he essentially ended up resigning and saying that I can't play these politics anymore, and they're blocking all of everything I want to do. Part of that came out of when Ismail Khan had decided to start rearming his militia in preparation for the leaving of So Ismail Khan decided that he was going to rearm his militia. And it was essentially in response to the American forces leaving, to the international forces leaving, and wanting to maintain his power base in his traditional area. And the governor's point was simply that we can't have these rogue paramilitaries running around, that anybody who has a gun needs to be in uniform and needs to be within the appropriate structure of security, security structure under the ministry's direction. And so essentially this ended up leading into this power struggle. The governor ended up resigning. So while I was there was basically a sit-in that was organized. There's a park across the street from the governor's house, from the governor's official residence. And people had come in and pitched tents. These were people from civil society organizations. They were people representing, they were various ministry people, so they were also government workers. And they had basically said, we're here until the governor comes back. And that Herathis have been getting used to a certain economic advancement, a certain economic progress. And it wasn't something that they wanted to give up and go back to the old school, sort of militia, strongman dominated, lack of process, patronage-based system. And it I to me that was very interesting, because there is a lot of conversation about so what happens post 2014? Do people go back to the way that things used to be? And the more I talk to people and the more time I spend there, it seems to me it's unlikely. I think that people have, if not empirically, at least in terms of the idea, conceptually, they've gotten used to the idea of something better. And for a lot of people, they've gotten used to actually having something better. This is within the context of understanding that I think personally that the sort of the grand experiment in Afghanistan has gone horribly wrong. But I think that within that, there are pockets of progress, and I think that people have seen opportunities for a better life. And so, I don't think that there's that huge danger of going all the way back. I mean, certainly that doesn't mean that those patronage politics and those ethnic-based, relationships are not going to be the primary way of doing things as they have always been, but at least there was this veneer of a system. So I thought that Herat was really interesting in that respect, that there is a real desire to not go back to the old ways. It'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I mean, the new governor that was appointed is really somebody who's seen as a friendly to Ismail Khan and is willing to play those patronage games. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, where do you put foreign influence? I mean, not foreign influence, but sort of Iran in Herat? I mean, are they trading with Iran? Is there Iranians in Herat? I mean, how do we characterize that western border and that sort of that area?
Well, I don't think you can discount the cultural influence. I mean, certainly, Herat feels culturally very different from other parts of Afghanistan that I've been in. And certainly, people go to Iran for schooling, they go there for work. It's kind of like the border between Pakistan and Kandahar, right? I mean, how do you stop that influence? The Iranians have their own sort of idea about historical Iran and what role Herat plays in that. And they have their own security concerns at that border as well. So to say that that relationship is insignificant, I think is mischaracterizing it. Herat is obviously just geographically much closer to Iran than it is to Kabul as well. And there's a certain, there's also a certain cultural sense of, I'm going to use the word superiority, but I don't want it to make it sound like arrogance. I think there's a certain sense that Herat is, home to a certain culture of refinement that doesn't exist in other places in Afghanistan. And I think Heratis are keenly aware of that. I was talking to a man who is who basically runs a sort of a coalition of groups that are, business and trade groups. He was a former member of parliament as well. And he was essentially, booted out of parliament through what he says is fraud, emanating directly from Karzai's office. And so he's certainly not terribly friendly to Karzai. But, there is a sense, of course, that if things in Kabul collapse, it's going to be problematic for Herat as well. And just given the size and the kind of influence that Iran can have, what does that mean for people living in that region? I don't think I'm sure there's a sense. I'm sure you can find people in Herat who would prefer closer alliances to Iran. I didn't speak to those people. I was there for a very specific purpose. But certainly I think that there's still a desire to maintain a very particular local cultural affiliation. And one that isn't aligned with a foreign power. So, yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know if that answers your question exactly.
It was great. let's switch over to Kabul. What is the sort of the feeling in Kabul? I mean, it seems like, Kabul would be the natural beneficiary of sort of U.S. aid and, donations and sort of the massive amount of money we're hearing about sort of pouring in. I mean, what do you think when the United States pulls out and NATO pulls out, I mean, what is the feeling there? I mean, is there, a sense of that a great deal of money is being lost and pulled out of the capital, or, what is the sense that you get?
Well, I think that for the people who were going to capitalize on that money, they've already done it, right? I mean, there's the standard, invoking of 80% of the funds stop in Dubai anyway, right? So I think that for people who were going to make out like bandits, they've already made out like bandits. I think that the uncertainty rests, let me back up a little bit. I think that, what's interesting, what you'll find is that there are a lot of people in Kabul, young people who are bringing in expertise that they've learned, young Afghans who are basically bringing their expertise, back into their own society. So some of these people are people who, went abroad as either refugees or immigrants, were able to get a good foreign education. For some that meant the West, for some that meant India, for some that meant Pakistan. You also have a lot of young people who've been able to get the benefit of a better education in the last decade or so within Afghanistan, well, in Kabul itself. And they're really trying very hard to figure out what that means for them. If you look at the population in Afghanistan, 75% of the population is under the age of 25. And so what you're going to be seeing in the next 10 years is this incredible, massive demographic shift, you know, where you're basically going to see the vast majority of people of this country come to an age where they are in a position of making decisions. The question that exists in Afghanistan right now is more about the future of that population. You know, what are they going to do for jobs? There's nowhere near enough jobs to keep these people employed. There's nowhere near enough positions at university for people who want to pursue higher education. The majority of these kids are not getting into university because there isn't the capacity to absorb them. And so the questions are more sort of, I don't want to say mundane, but I think that they're more day-to-day questions than questions that the West seems to be enamored with, like what's going to happen with the insurgency or what's going to happen with this faction or that faction. I think that the day-to-day questions for Afghans really are about what am I going to do for work and where am I going to go to school? You know, but then at the same time, you have to remember that the vast majority of Afghans are also, they're illiterate, right? These aren't the people that are participating in these conversations. So I think when you look at the conversations that are happening in Kabul, there is a lot of, among the young people, I would say that there is a degree of optimism. I think that they are the ones that are well placed already, the ones who are already in good jobs, the ones who are already doing interesting things. And there's a whole other conversation to have about, you know, who those people are. But I think that they are excited to see what they can do for themselves. It's an opportunity to prove themselves. And I think that they're keen to do that. As far as the negativity and the pessimism, that's there too, because obviously you can talk about grand ideals, but when your economy, you don't really have an economy, you don't really have any opportunity to give people any kind of meaningful employment. And the employment that does exist is very much based on patronage. It's difficult for people to find meaningful work. You know, what does that say for increased migration of young people? What does that say for increased illegal migration? What does that say for, criminal activity? What does that say for the insurgency? All of these other questions tend to get built on, you know, what are the opportunities for young people today and what is that going to mean going forward? And I don't know what you can say about that with any certainty other than something needs to be done. You know, what that something is, I think, is people are still talking about that, unfortunately.
Let me ask you about the economy. I mean, you know, in your travels in Kabul and Herat, I mean, is the economy healthy? I mean, is there, from your perspective, you know, an economy that's sort of, you know, the engine is sort of revved up and going, so to speak, to use a poor analogy, but I mean, aside from sort of future jobs, I mean, is the economy, you know, vibrant?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, it's kind of like this, it's kind of like a faux economy, right? I mean, the economy relies almost entirely on foreign aid. So within that context, yeah, there are people that have massive amounts of money and they're going out there and they're spending it, right? You can go out and you can have a really decent, expensive meal. And by expensive, I'm talking from my own perspective. I mean, granted, I'm a freelance journalist, so maybe my standards are really low, but, those opportunities for that kind of, engagement, consumer engagement, they do exist. But the question is how much of that economy is being locally fueled? Not very much, right? I mean, there is no manufacturing going on. There is no industry as such. You see a lot of consumer related, huge shopping malls and things for sale and restaurants and there are people out in the street and they're buying things, but and going places and all of that kind of thing. But it's still the people who are making money off this essentially faux economy. And so what about that economy that exists outside of that, right? the people that are not part of that economy, who are essentially working on a subsistence level, you know, how much can they participate in the economy? You know, not very much, because they're simply not making enough to be involved, you know, in that same way that these other Afghans are. You can see sort of successful models of business that people are bringing in from other places. But how sustainable is it? You know, you see tons and tons and tons of apartment buildings going up, but who's going to move into them? So I think that, you know, we always talk about this idea of Afghanistan as, you know, it's bustling and there's this happening and there's that happening, but we rarely talk about sort of the basic question, which is, once the foreign money stops, you know, what is going to replace that? I would suggest drug money probably, but you know, in lieu of drug money, what else exists? I don't think there is anything else.
So on the topic of drug money, I mean, I'm sort of glad you brought it up. You know, in your travels, you know, how much, I mean, you know, from the Western media, right? So you read sort of like Gretchen Peters, who's done a lot of great work on the Afghan drug trade. You know, from this perspective, you know, from reading her, it just seems like the drug trade is huge. It's not only huge, but it's this native industry that cuts everybody in, you know. Yeah. But I mean, in your travels, I mean, is this something that is reflected on the ground? I mean, in Kabul and Herat, I mean, is opium trade something that is sort of done in the open and people talk about, or is it still sort of illicit and sort of, you know, something that you have to be engaged in on the low, and sort of, it's not, you don't bring it up at dinner, basically?
Well, I mean, there are probably other journalists that are far better positioned to answer that question. That's not something I look into. I find it very interesting and I read about it, but it's not something those are not the stories that I do. Certainly in terms of conversations, these are conversations that come up all the time, right? About how drug money, you know, is essentially how it's laundered through the regular economy, and that how, you know, everything has drug money behind it or in it or, you know, running through it to some degree. And so, you know, there have been conversations. I've talked to development workers, for example, and consultants who've said that they've actually had conversations in meetings about, you know, perhaps, you know, being less stringent about the use of drug money for development work, right? I mean, things like that. Like, so if a drug baron wants to build a school, you know, like, maybe that's okay. Because at least, you know, because that's what the economy is based on, and that's what people are doing. And the government is so direct. I mean, the level of criminality in the government is, the two things are so tightly wound together that the idea of separating out dirty money from clean money just doesn't make any sense. I have this friend, Sipi Azerbaijani Mogadam, who is a very, she's a long time worker in Afghanistan. She's a consultant and she's been working in the country since the mid 1990s. And she's absolutely brilliant. I would seriously encourage you to have her on your program. And she and I were having a discussion and she gave me this analogy. She said that Afghanistan is like a gilded turd. And so when you look at it from outside, people like to look at all of its glitter and its shine and its shimmer. But as soon as you cut into it, it stinks like shit. And the thing is, I mean, my point in repeating that is not to denigrate Afghans. And it's not to denigrate the really hard work that a lot of people have done. But it's just to try to create, you know, an analogy that really speaks to, you know, what's been created out of this last 10 or 12 years. And I'm not laying the blame at the foot of the Americans or the internationals or, you know, I mean, so there's so much that's gone wrong in so many ways. And this is essentially what we've ended up with. And I have to say that I don't disagree with her in terms of her metaphor. And so I think that, you know, that's, and the other part of it, I mean, all of this ties in together. I know that my answers are kind of a little bit incoherent and rambling, but every time I say something, I want to say one more thing. You know, you have to also, I think, take a look at the level of expertise that you have within Afghanistan. I mean, you know, all of the stories that I've heard and the people, frankly, that I've met that are in positions where they're, you know, where they're trying to steer the course are not necessarily people. It seems to me that a lot of people are in over their heads, right? You've got you've got very young people doing, you know, sitting in positions that require a level of expertise that I think that they just don't have. But there's this rush to kind of quote unquote Afghanize the face of the government. And I think that in many ways, the desire for having someone more rigorous, it gets pushed to the side in favor of what's more politically appealing. And I think that that's happened in a variety of sectors. And so, you know, I don't really know what's going to become of it. I mean, if your enforcers are people who have like a tenth of the experience as the drug runners, then what's going to happen, right?
Interesting. So let's sort of switch gears over to Pakistan. I mean, what is the feeling there? I mean, it seems like you traveled Pakistan more extensively, so I imagine you have a sort of wider range of opinion. But you know, I think in our previous conversations with you and sort of Colin Cookman, you know, I think the show gets the sense that, you know, that Pakistan is sort of becoming more democratic. I mean, it's slow, but it's on that trajectory. So what is the sense that when the United States pulls out, I mean, who's going to be affected? Who's the winner? Who's the loser? I mean, what is the feeling?
Well, I think what you see right now is really an attempt within Pakistan for the civilian government to recalibrate its position, right? To really kind of come to a different understanding of where it sits vis-a-vis the military. And I think that there are a variety of things that have allowed it to recalibrate itself in favor of having a higher status, right? Part of it is sort of judicial activism. Part of it is the military itself sort of stepping back a little bit, partly because of, you know, for lack of a better term, well, maybe it is the best term, because of some enduring humiliations, perceived humiliations. I think that the civilian government has been more willing to speak out on certain things. But I think that in general, I mean, if you're talking about Pakistanis, I think that there's a definite sense of being besieged. I think that Pakistanis feel overwhelmed at every turn. There doesn't seem to be any real respite from, you know, the violence or the corruption or just the day-to-day hassles of the lack of electricity and the problems with water and the lack of law enforcement, and everywhere you turn, there's something horrible happening somewhere. Our conversations about Pakistan here they tend to be overly focused on the US's military actions, well, the US's CIA actions, the open secret of its drone strikes. I don't think that drone conversation is as pronounced in Pakistan as it is in the US. I think, you know, people see that as one of many, many problems that exist in that country. There's a growing trend toward a more sort of democratic, in favor of democracy. But I think that, you know, that's just very early days yet, right? I mean, this is only the first time we've ever seen that kind of transition from one democratic government to another. I think it still remains to be seen how it plays out. Certainly there's existing, you know, there's ongoing criticism of the new government as well. There's ongoing criticism of how this government is going to deal with militancy. There's a move right now to try to come up with some sort of national security policy, something that's never existed in the country before, which is like incredibly strange and weird, that a country with the kind of insecurity that Pakistan faces, domestic insecurity, does not have some kind of comprehensive policy on how to deal with it. And so a lot of that remains to be seen. But I would say that just from the perspective of just ordinary people, I would say that, yeah, there's definitely a sense of being overwhelmed and feeling besieged at every turn. And it's very stressful. Like, I can't begin to, you know, emphasize how stressed people are. And, you know, just, I mean, like literally stressed to the point of illness. Like, you know, it's just amazing how much stress people deal with. You leave your house in the morning, you don't know if you're going to come back at night. And that's a, like a literal, that's not some sort of metaphor that people invoke. It's like literally true for people.
Interesting. So, I mean, what is the feeling in the military? I mean, did you talk to military people, and sort of what is the feeling of you know, military and intelligence people, ISI, you know, with the United States leaving? I mean, it seems like, I mean, I guess this is more of a layman's history, but it seems like there was a very much sort of close connection between the United States and Pakistan. And now sort of the United States is leaving, but, you know, and what hasn't been sussed out yet is sort of the depth of connection that the U.S. is willing to sort of engage in, and the depth of the connection that the Pakistanis are willing to tolerate. I mean, I think that's why sort of the drone conversation is so big in the United States, is that it's a sort of a marker for a greater issue, which is, you know, how do you define your relationship with the Pakistanis after 10 years? But I mean, you know, that's sort of a side note, but, you know, what is the conversation in Pakistan about, especially with the military, you know, with its relationship with the United States? I mean, is that a conversation, you know, besides putting the drones aside?
Well, I don't think that the American government really talks to the civilian government. I mean, other than just, you know, maybe sort of, you know, the kind of public relations type of conversations. I think that when it comes to U.S. interests in the country and in the region, the American government has always talked to the military, you know, and that's actually agreements that you know, people working in government and with government have in Pakistan, that the American government has consistently over the course of its relationship with the country, and we're not talking post 9/11, we're talking right from the first days, has always been of going to the military. It hasn't been of seeking out its civilian counterparts. They always go to the generals. And that, I think, is enduring. I don't think that that's going to change. So when you talk about any kind of security-based relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, I think that it's irrelevant to talk about what the civilian government thinks. The civilian government doesn't really exert any force in that arena. I don't think anybody really even cares to talk to them about what that means. So, you know, as far as American security interests in Pakistan and, you know, in terms of border issues, it'll just carry on talking to the military the way it's always been talking to the military. And the civilian government is always kind of peeking over the wall, trying to get in on the conversation. And the military will tell the civilians whatever they feel they need to know. They get their briefings. And they're basically told what the briefings have happened with every single government. The briefings essentially outline what the military what the military thinks are the priority issues. You know, the civilian government can pump up the rhetoric all it wants. It's not effectively going to have any impact. As far as, you know, it's an interesting thing. Like I think that. You know, I hope I phrased this correctly. I think that for the most part, the relationship between, you know, it's interesting when the Americans characterize the relationship between itself and Pakistan. Pakistan is always sort of characterized as duplicitous, can't be trusted. You know, it's you know, is this an enemy or a friend, and all of that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, it seems to me that the feeling is the Americans, like from the Pakistani perspective, from the military perspective, is that the Americans have always been fairly naive in thinking that their security agenda is going to be the security agenda in the region. I mean, you know, the Pakistanis have been playing this game for a very long time, and they know what their objectives are, and why would they sacrifice those broader objectives for essentially you know, satisfying the Americans for a handful of years. They're not going to do that. The Pakistanis are thinking in the long term. And so, you know, with the Americans leaving Afghanistan, I don't think that that's really going to have any impact on the relationship between Pakistan and the U.S. I think they will still have those conversations between the groups of people that have always talked. And, you know, and the Pakistan military is one that really is, it's really one that sees threats around every corner, and it literally sees these threats. It's not even projected threats. It very literally sees itself besieged at every border point, with every single country and every neighbor that it has. So, you know, I don't see anything significantly changing in that relationship.
Interesting. I mean, how does Pakistan sort of conceptualize Afghanistan in the long term then? Because, I mean, sort of the national security establishment of Pakistan has always sort of thought, you know, three moves ahead or the long term. I mean, where is Afghanistan falling in sort of in this sort of line of thinking? I mean, it seems like, you know, the argument in the 90s was if you build enough ties to the Taliban, then you can hold the south of the country and then you could sort of, you know, have your cake and eat it too, so to speak. But, you know, I mean, what is the thinking about Afghanistan post-2013, post-2014?
Well, I think that there have been some overtures made by the civilian government and there's certainly been a lot written about the idea of having a more equitable relationship, right? That, I mean, and then, of course, it comes down to that sort of idealism that's put forward by it's kind of characterized as being a very sort of liberal type of idealism, that if we have more respect between the nations and we see each other as equals, then we're less likely to see each other as vehicles for exercising our own power. There have been some moves made, you know, there's Afghan students that come to Pakistan on scholarship and things like that. But, you know, I think, you know, the important thing to understand about Pakistan is that it's always been a country that has had its security decisions led by a military view, right? It's always been the military that's made those decisions. The majority of the country's existence has been under military government. And those views have become the entrenched views. And so the idea that somehow there's going to be some radical shift in how the Pakistani security establishment views Afghanistan, I think that to me seems unrealistic. I mean, you know, I haven't had sort of insidery conversations with anybody in the military or the ISI. I mean, this is based on conversations with analysts and with other people that I know and just watching events. But to me, it's like, why would anyone, you know, what is the impetus to change one's worldview? Afghanistan, it's kind of like every time Afghanistan sort of torques and aligns itself more closely with India, whether on cultural issues or on social issues or on security issues, that winds up the Pakistani security establishment even more. And that is that's a very delicate dance that's going on right now. And the Americans try to inject themselves in that, you know, trying to placate Pakistan on one side and try to calm India down on the other side and try to explain to Afghanistan on the third side, you know, why you can't go rushing into the arms of the Indians all the time. And sometimes it feels like the Afghans are going after the Indians purposely to kind of, you know, like it's very high school, right? Like it feels like it's sort of some high school drama that gets played out in the region. But I think that, it's really important to understand how much, that ultimately how much that fear of Indian, influence in the region affects everything. And, you know, Afghanistan is part of that. I don't see that changing. I think that there are some efforts on the civilian side, to see greater cooperation. If you look at, for example, trade relations within South Asia, there is a trade organization that exists. But the cooperation rate, I think within South Asian nations, I think the last number I looked at from a couple of years ago was like 5%. It's a region that has one of the lowest rates of inter-regional trade. And if you look at goods flowing from Pakistan to Afghanistan, it's essentially one way. there isn't any sort of reciprocal, there isn't any reciprocity in that sense, because there's nothing really being created in Afghanistan that can come into, there's a real complaint that they just flood us with cheap goods and then we can't compete. So, I think that there are bigger issues here than just the military issues. There really isn't any relationship that exists economically. There's certainly a relationship between people, but that really does have to expand into something that looks more like a relationship rather than just sort of one side kind of using the other side, which I think is how I would characterize it. I think it's more fair to characterize it the second way than the first way right now.
So I want to sort of end the show with the elephant in the room, or I guess the elephant in the room, that analogy works, and that's the Taliban. I mean, where do we put them in sort of all this? I mean, it seems like it was that sort of movement, organization, which sort of brought the United States into Afghanistan and sort of, it's sort of largely considered Pakistan's creation, or sort of they were the ones who gave that movement electricity to sort of wake it up. But, where do we put the Taliban in all this? I mean, what are their views? What are they thinking? How are they sort of conceptualizing or understanding the U.S. withdrawal?
Well, I think that the idea that, first of all, the idea that somehow the Taliban represent a way of thinking that is so far removed from what you'll find in Afghanistan in general, I think that that's wrong. I think that you'll find that type of thinking in terms of like this very conservative, religiously conservative, culturally conservative, ethnically focused. Like, I think that that's pretty common in Afghanistan. I think you would be surprised. I mean, I'm always surprised at how people seem to think that, or like to point out that somehow the Taliban thinking is something outside and different from what you might find in Afghanistan in general. I think it's very typical of a kind of thinking that exists. I meet people like that all the time, right? You'll find people that will advocate for those types of laws and rules and norms that are sitting in government. And we've seen that again and again with various kinds of controversies that have erupted around women's rights or human rights and things like that. Warlordism is certainly not anything that's been done away with. That exists and it's thriving. As far as the Taliban itself goes, so where does that conversation sit right now? It doesn't really sit anywhere. We sort of have these mini eruptions of elation that, there's going to be talks now. And then the talks always fall apart. The Taliban have been very clear that they're not going to have talks until the Americans leave. Well, what does that look like? I mean, who are the people that make up the Taliban, right? These are people that everybody knows. These are people that are connected to people that are sitting in government. How is bringing them in any different than the people that are already in government? Is it going to effectively make things better or worse? Are things, would things get better without the Taliban? Like, I think all of these questions are unresolved. I don't know that you can actually answer those questions. People say, the Taliban and their conservatism. Well, does that conservatism already exists in government right now, right? The Taliban don't want women working. Well, you'll find scores of people right now who don't want women working. The Taliban are not interested in talking about human rights. Well, human rights are already been, something that people are not interested in talking about. I mean, we've seen this comprehensive report on human rights violations that has been suppressed to this day, that's never seen the light of day because it's not politically viable to have it come out that people sitting in government today have been responsible or implicated in massacres. We don't want militarism. Well, is militarism not a problem right now? So, that this whole idea about the Taliban coming in and sort of qualitatively making things worse, I'm not convinced, right? And then the other question is, who, right? Like, which Taliban? There's, it's so factionalized right now, and the people that are willing to talk are not the people that are necessarily still fighting. Like, I mean, there's these groups are so different, and they're so broken apart, and you know, so if you settle with one group, what does that say for another group? So to me, just, you know, wrestling with that whole question about what happens if the Taliban come back, or what is the Taliban's position, you know, in terms of the American withdrawal. Well, we know what their position is in terms of the American withdrawal, but I don't know that things are going to be effectively any different or worse than they are now. That's not a vote of support for the Taliban. I don't want anyone to think that I'm kind of some kind of apologist, but I'm just not convinced that they're going to come, that the particular faction that people are interested in talking to, or that is willing to talk, is going to come in and make things markedly worse than they already are. You know, I think it remains to be seen.
Interesting. So before we end, I mean, our conversation has been pretty sort of comprehensive, but, you know, give us a sort of, you know, summary comment or something to leave the audience with to sort of chew on, to think about.
Oh, no pressure. I think that, you know, we're you know, in the media and, you know, with analysts and with policymakers, we're always in such a rush to come to some kind of conclusion about what something will mean, right, in the short term. And I think that having short-term conversations about this region are essentially useless, because I think that we see what we think is happening in the short term actually unfolds in an entirely different way in the long term. And I think that, you know, these are conversations we're going to need to continue to revisit over the years, right? This is not just something we're going to look at for 6 months or until the end of 2014 or even until like 6 months into 2015. I think that the ramifications of all of this, you know, when, like, just one small example, Bagram. Like, if you look at Bagram prison, I mean, now it's got a different, what is it, detention facility in Parwan. You know, there's a whole whack of foreign detainees at Bagram that are under American control. And the Americans have not decided what they want to do with them. And so they're essentially in indefinite detention under American jurisdiction in a foreign country. And so far, the American courts have decided that this is something that the American courts can't get involved in because Afghanistan has a particular status. So what is this going to mean after 2014, right? What is the status of these detainees after 2014? And we know that people have been moved from Guantanamo to Bagram to shield them from certain sort of process issues, legal process issues. So, you know, there are a lot of ongoing things that are going to carry on past 2014. And so I think that, you know, talking about the short term is really something that we have to kind of try to avoid doing, so that, you know, we really need to sort of keep our eye on things as we go forward. Otherwise, we're not going to properly understand, you know, what our role was in the place in the first place.
Interesting. So thank you so much for coming on.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Take care then.
Okay.